I can get started, so I'd like to welcome you to this EWO seminar, Enterprise-Wide Optimization. And today I have the special pleasure of introducing Dr. John Cirola, who's in fact an alumnus of the department. John actually obtained his undergraduate degree at Purdue in 2000, and actually he did a co-op, but he was an undergrad with Air Products. Then he came here and did a PhD in work with both Stan and Howen and Art Westbrook, and the topic of his research was related to the use of agent-based methods for multi-objective optimization of non-convex MI NLP, so you can go as complicated as you want, and also with the use and application of distributed computing. John joined Sandia in 2005, and he's currently the senior member of the technical staff of a group that's called Exploratory Simulation Technologies, and that has to do, I guess, with a lot of advanced computing. And just to give you, if you wish, a little bit of an idea of the work that's involved there, it's involved the use of Python, and one of the things that John has also done is the development of a modeling system, algebraic modeling system called PyOMA. In fact, on tomorrow, he's going to give us a workshop on that topic. At any rate, so John has been involved, again, in a number of projects, and as you can see from the slide, has been also collaborating with quite a few people, like David Woodruff, who's very well known in the area of stochastic optimization, and, of course, Bill Hart at Sandia, especially on advanced computing, and a number of other people. So with that, further ado, let me welcome John. Okay, John, thank you.
Thank you, Ignacio. You're also reminding me how out of date our website is, because we've been reorged a couple times since then and departments change. But in essence, I'm still doing the same kind of things. When Ignacio asked me to actually give a talk on enterprise-wide optimization, I thought that this would actually be a fun topic. So this is going to be a talk about something that's a little bit different, I think, than what you normally hear about, and that we're going to be talking about the electric power grid. The idea behind this talk is we're going to talk a little bit about the problem, we're going to talk a lot about modeling, and we'll talk a little bit about algorithmics. Okay, so this is kind of going to be a whirlwind tour of a whole bunch of things. As Ignacio mentioned, I'm kind of putting the cart before the horse, because tomorrow I get to babble about our Python modeling environment, and today I'm going to show you advanced features that we're using in the Python modeling environment. So we'll see how this goes. I can't give any talk without acknowledging a lot of people. One of the nice things about working at the labs is that we always tend to work in large groups, and so the people I particularly want to acknowledge are David Woodruff, Bill Hart, and Jean-Paul Watson. They're the other co-leads, along with Carl Laird, the co-leads of this Cooper software package, and two students, Zev Freeman and Jack Ingalls, who did a lot of the work that I'm going to be presenting today. So, without further ado, does anybody know anything about the power grid? One. Okay. Two, three, four. Good. It's an interesting system in that, if you think about it, it's not all that dissimilar from any other process industry that we play with, except that some things are a lot easier. They have one species, right? It's an electron. Okay. They have pressure, except they call it voltage. There's a little bit weird things because they worry about these things about phase angles and whatnot, but we'll brush all that under the side. The simple thing is they want to distribute electric power from wherever it is they're generating it to wherever it is they use it, so that when I turn on a light switch, the lights come on. Okay? And the way we do that is interesting. I'm going to talk a lot of acronyms, and in particular, we're going to talk a little bit about ISOs or RTOs, or balancing authorities. These are the people that are in charge of making sure that the grid works. Okay? That is, that there's sufficient voltage and the power is, the phase angles are right and everything works so that when you turn on a switch, the lights come on. Okay? The trick is they have to balance generation and load virtually instantaneously 24/7. Okay? They have to do it at the lowest possible cost. That's their objective function. Okay. The catch is, unlike everything else we do where, okay, if the dynamics are weird, we just put in a storage tank and that makes all our problems go away. There is little to no storage in the electric grid. Okay? So the question becomes, how do you respond to disturbances? How do you respond to changes in load? Particularly when your ability to change generation is limited by the types of generation. Okay? I have this little note about how we do it, and the answer is right now, and we'll talk a little bit about this again in a minute, is we absorb a lot of these disturbances through a thing called spinning reserves. That is, generators that are online spinning but not really putting out power, and they can be ramped up very quickly. Okay? The problem is, I mean, we all know about load variability. The nice thing is, believe it or not, that's remarkably deterministic. We can predict load remarkably accurately. Okay, the problem now is that we're integrating not what they call non-dispatchable generation and what the rest of the world calls renewable resources. And what that basically means is, I can't tell a wind turbine, I need power now, please make the wind blow. Okay, so there's where our problem is coming from. And to steal slides from NREL, the problem is now that my control, which is, if you think about it, what our ISOs and RTOs are doing is they're doing a series of online control. Okay, and what they used to have to follow was load, and that's this nice purple line at the top. And this is 1 week out of April, I think from 2006, and it's got this nice pattern, and believe it or not, that weekly period is remarkably stable. We can get into it, but it turns out that that starts on a Monday. And you know this because Saturday and Sunday always look different, and Friday looks like halfway between a Thursday and a Saturday. I don't know why, but that's, I think everybody goes home at noon. Okay. The problem is, as I introduce non-dispatchable generation, what I can control, my dispatchable generation, now doesn't have to follow the load. It has to follow net load. That is, load minus renewable generation. Okay, and so the next three lines, green, red, and blue, are increasing levels of non-dispatchable generation, 10, 20, and 30%. And most of that turns out to be wind. And I will admit that I'm cherry-picking a particularly nasty test case here. But what you're looking at are the dynamics and the fact that I lose some things. So, for example, I lose weekly periodicity. Okay? The purple line at the top is my original load, and you see I've got this really nice kind of weekly periodicity. The variation in there is almost all can be attributed to things like temperature and relative humidity. Okay, so we can model that. If I go to 30% renewable, now I've got this nasty jagged blue line I've got to follow. Okay? So the question is, how do we do that? The other nasty thing I should mention is I have to start controlling things that we would rather not control. So on the left, you see a typical way we do what's called unit allocation, that is, or unit commitment, that is, what generators are going to be generating what. And if you notice, from, we call it baseload for a reason. If you work from the bottom up, they get increasing responsibility for responding to dynamics in the system. So at the bottom, it turns out things like coal, nuclear, are considered baseload. You don't ramp those if you don't have to. Cogen will ramp a little bit. Oh, I'm sorry. For those of you playing along at home, it's slide 5. We'll ramp a little bit with cogen, but almost all of our ramping comes from what's called quick start generators, and which are natural gas turbines. Okay, that's how we operate today. If you start adding renewable, in particular, this is from the Western Wind Study, so they're looking at a high penetration of wind resources in the western United States. That, first of all, displaces 30% of your generation nominally. But it also means that now we have to start responding to dynamics inside of plants that we would rather not ramp. So in our base load, base generating capacity, in particular our coal plants. The last nasty thing is, unlike load, forecasting renewables is bad. The blue or the red SOA forecast, that's state-of-the-art wind forecast. Okay, the black line was real. Again, taken from an NREL study, and you can see the error can be as much as 100%. Okay, this is pretty tough. So what do you do? Well, you increase reserves, but that's kind of counterintuitive. If I put a major wind plant online, that also means I need to put on a major fast start natural gas generating plant as well and leave it spinning. Okay, because all of this has to do with responding to dynamics. So a word about the example problem. How do we do this today? Well, we can't solve the problem we want to solve, so we solve it in a series of three simpler problems that are solvable. Because remember, we do this a day ahead, and tomorrow's going to come whether or not we're ready. Okay, midnight's going to come when midnight comes, whether or not we have an optimal solution to any of these problems. So a lot of the focus of the way things are done now, in the real world, is on getting an implementable answer in time. And they do it in three stages. The first thing they do is they solve what's called the unit commitment problem. That is, on an hourly basis for the next 24 hours, what generators are going to be online? Okay, this is a mixed integer linear problem. Okay, and they can basically solve it if they don't consider things like the network. Generally, the unit commitment model uses what's called a single bus model. So they don't consider restrictions imposed by the transmission network. Okay? But of course, we have a transmission network and it imposes restrictions. So the next thing they do a few hours later is they solve what's called the reliability unit commitment model, where they sit there and they take the answer. And each one of these is a market. So out of each one of these comes commitments that the ISO or the RTO make to the generating entities. It's done as a bid and accept. So the way these guys play is that the generators submit cost curves that the ISO then puts into its unit commitment optimization model, which then tries to do a min cost kind of assignment. Okay? That comes with a certain set of commitments. Then the next thing they do is this reliability, where they want to make sure that the network constraints don't cause us problems. And so this imposes things like spinning reserves. This does introduce the usually introduces the network structure back into the problem. But because most of the unit commitment problem's already been solved, this now becomes reasonably solvable. Okay. The other thing they worry about in reliability unit commitment is exactly this, reliability. That is, we ought to be able, in fact, by regulation, you have to be able to survive the loss of any one entity, that is a transmission line, non-leaf transmission line, or generating. Okay, you have to be able to survive the loss of any one thing without loss of load. Okay? And so this is a secondary problem that they solve to basically allocate additional resources that may not be generating but need to be online. Okay? Then the last thing they do is every 5 minutes, well, they do it at 2 hour and 1 hour and 5 minutes, they solve what's called economic dispatch problems, which are now setting actual generating levels for every one of your generators. This is nice. We have to solve them quickly, but they're LPs because we're not turning a state, right? So we have no discrete decisions. We're not turning generators on and off. We're just setting output levels. And so that's a nice LP. Okay. The catch here is the problem scale. An ISO or RTO network is between hundreds to thousands of buses. Hundreds to thousands of buses with 2 to 3 times that number of transmission lines. Okay? Not small problems. So here's the answer. Okay? I'm done. Here's the answer. In fact, I didn't even write this. This came out of literature. For those playing along, this is slide 8. This is a very nice model that we took out of literature from Corey Hedman and Mike Ferris and Dick O'Neill and Shmuel Oren. Along with Emily Bartholomew, I believe, was also an author on this. This is basically the first two problems put into one, plus a little bit. So this is a model for unit commitment with N-1 reliability, and they add one more thing to it. They add transmission switching. So it turns out that if you look at network flow problems, there are cases where closing a line makes a system less stable. You can decrease the flow on a network by adding an additional arc. And so the idea is if we can open arcs in our transmission network, we can make the network overall more stable. Okay, so this is a little bit more complicated than what I just presented, but it's a problem we'd really like to be able to solve. Now, of course, this is completely obvious to everybody sitting in this room what this model is for, right? And you'd like to think that this is nice. Okay, I've got a unit commitment model with transmission switching. When you look at it, actually, it's not that nicely layered. I'm now on slide 9. What you find is that all of these parts of the model get very tightly interconnected. Okay, and when you write it down, you lose a lot, at least in my mind. In fact, I'll get one part that we lost until we'd been working with the model for maybe 4 weeks. There was a very little subtlety in there about the transmission switching, which if you track the indices very carefully is painfully obvious. But if you're just reading through the model, you miss it. Okay? I tried to color code this to say, well, nominally what parts of what equations are dealing with what portions of the model. And you really kind of hoped that it was this nice structured model, but you find that certain aspects get introduced by just adding an index to an equation. And others are adding specific terms or changing terms, and it gets, unfortunately, very tightly interconnected. And that makes it hard, at least for people like me, hard to understand. It certainly makes it hard to communicate, and heaven forbid you want to change the model at all. You lose, I'm now on slide 10, you lose a lot of structure in this too. Okay, this model really does have the structure that I described. Okay, in that we start off with, we have an optimal power flow, that is, we're going to model how the power flows through the network. It's got the economic dispatch portion, setting generator levels in there. And it's got some switching decisions. That makes this nice little block. Okay, and then if we're going to do N minus 1, well, that's really, it's a form of robust optimization in that I'm going to do this power flow model for my base case, and then I'm going to do it for each of my contingencies. So I get this really nice block diagonal structure, and they're linked by the fact that they all have to be reachable from the base case, from the nominal case. Okay? And then if I'm going to do a unit commitment, I'm really just doing a bunch of these N minus 1 contingency power flow models, one for every hour in the day. This is very nice structure here, okay? Except that you don't see it in the original model. And what's worse is you're missing one more thing. I say it's got this very nice block diagonal structure, but it's really this two-dimensional mesh. And this is the part that we missed for a couple weeks. It took Zev coming to me going, you know, this isn't the way you explained it. And I'm like, oh, great. In that the switching decisions in this particular model are not allowed in the contingencies. Okay, so what we have is this kind of two-dimensional way of thinking about things, and the image on the right is trying to explain this in time across the horizontal axis and contingencies across the vertical axis. So I have switching optimal power flow blocks that allow for transmission switching, hooked together to make a unit commitment, and then off of every stage, every time period, we have these N-1 contingency optimal power flows that are effectively auxiliary constraints on the unit commitment model. Okay, that's what we've really got. And explaining that took me how many minutes? Okay. So here's where I'm going to talk a little bit about modeling. One of the things we did with this is we said we'd really like to be able to model this in a way that looks a lot more like the way we want to talk about it. In particular, because we need to interface with people who aren't optimization folks. Okay, we have to interface with ISOs, we have to interface with utilities, regulators, all of whom want to be able to talk about these models and understand what they're doing. And what we introduced for this is the idea of block-oriented modeling. And it's a very simple idea. Okay, it's just the idea that I ought to be able to express components of my model in a named entity. All right, and in a sense, it's nothing more than a collection of variable sets, parameters, equations. Okay, this is not a big concept. The nice thing is I can arbitrarily nest these, so I can have blocks of blocks of blocks, and I get this very nice hierarchical structure. And what can I do with this? I can make modeling libraries of little components of an equation-based modeling system. I can have a nice correlation between the equations that represent an object, a physical entity in my problem, and the block. So I have a handle on something that I can name a physical entity, which is very nice. I can manipulate these as entities, and this automatically, in a certain sense, documents the structure of my model, which I can use later. Okay? Now, this isn't new. We've been doing this for simulation for decades, right? I mean, pick Aspen. This is Aspen, right? I have blocks. Each block corresponds to a physical unit. It's got an interface with reality, okay? But we want to do this in an equation-based modeling environment, okay? And I should point out that this isn't all that new there. I mean, Ascend has done this for years. JMedelica.org also does this, where they can do named blocks in an equation-oriented modeling system, okay? And the last thing I should say is, for those of you who like AMPL a lot, this really is more than just suffixes. It's more than just labeling. And the addition comes because I can do hierarchies easily without trying to do some convoluted thing in the suffix labels. I could do it if I had to, but this is so much more convenient. A little bit about the software. So this is the environment we're going to be talking about. I'm going to use two names almost interchangeably. Cooper turns out to be the name of the package. Paiomo is the name of the modeling environment. It's a part of Cooper, but not all of Cooper. The idea is that we can do algebraic modeling inside of native Python, and that's what Paiomo provides. We can then do extensions to this to support other things. So we can do language extensions for example, first-class support for disjunctive programming or stochastic programming, and hopefully in the next couple 2 months, we're going to have support for differential algebraic equations as well. Thanks to Larry. I've stolen one of his students. But then we can also leverage the fact that I've got the structure and I've got the model in an open and manipulatable environment to do clever things, in particular to do decomposition. And we'll talk about progressive hedging a little bit later, but you can also do the same thing with a generalized Bender's approach. And there's a very nice set of decomposition tools from Ted Ralphs at Lehigh called DIP, and we're working on interfacing with that as well. In any event, once I've got all of that in my modeling environment, then there's some core infrastructure that lets us move to a pluggable solver interface and then talk to whatever solver you like. And we have direct interfaces to a lot of the LP solvers, and we can, without going into too many of the gory details, we can generate NL files. So anybody who's hooked to AMPL, we can talk to. Okay, piece of cake. What is Paiomo? Nothing more than yet another modeling environment. But the cute thing about this one is that it is native Python. So the idea is we ought to be able to formulate, specify, and solve math programming problems natively inside of Python. And it supports all the things that you know and love. The guys who originally started this, Bill and Jean-Paul, started this project. They're both AMPL people. So if you like to code in AMPL, you are going to feel somewhat at home. It's not that dissimilar from GAMS. We actually support both modes. I'll talk a lot about this on Friday and very little about this today. But the really nice thing is I've got all the power of Python. I'm writing in a programming language. I don't have to write my own parser. If you want to change the syntax, if you want to add something to it, you can without having to worry about the core. Okay. And in fact, that's how we got disjunctive programming support originally, was it was to prove that, yes, indeed, what we've been saying about this was true. So on a whim, we said, okay, let's go write a disjunctive programming model and write the transformations to generate Big M and Convex Hull. We'll get into that in a minute. This is a little example. I should have mentioned this. We're on slide 14, and I'm going to look at the box. This is a simple model to do a little bit of nonlinear programming, but you can get kind of the flavor of it. I'm not going to talk much more about syntax here other than it looks kind of obvious. I'm going to create a bunch of variables, dangle them off a model. In this case, I'm just going to create an objective with a particular expression. Okay, not terribly complicated. So what does this mean for electric grid? I mean, that is what we're here to talk about. And we wanted to think about or change the way we thought about this problem from more of a tinker toy approach. That is, I've got a bunch of nodes, I've got a bunch of arcs, I've got a bunch of generators. I'd like to hook them up together in this kind of tinker toy approach. Okay? So I'm going to take each of these physical components, I'm going to stick them inside a block, and then I'm going to figure out a way to wire these blocks together. And we do this through a construct we call connectors. And they're basically just named bags of variables. And I can form a constraint across a connector, and then at some point later in time, that constraint gets replicated for corresponding variables inside of the bag. And that's really nice, because I can logically specify a network flow model without telling you anything about what's flowing across the network. Okay? So what does it look like? Well, the simplest thing I can think of is a DC line. All right, and so this is slide 16. A line has an input and an output. It's got some local parameters. In this case, it's a susceptance and a flow limit. It's got three variables that matter. That is the voltage angle on the input and the output side, and then the flow across the line. Okay, I should say this isn't a direct current model. This is, in the power systems, they call a DC flow, or DC OPF, DC optimal power flow model. It's actually a linearization of the real AC model. They make a small angle assumption, and so they get a nice linear equation. Okay, so it's not direct current, but you'll get into it. The constraint is this small angle assumption, so our susceptance times the difference in voltage angle specifies our power flow across the line. Okay, real simple. The last thing we do, and it's in red at the bottom, is this, I hope it's in red.
Does this projector work?
Yeah, almost. Is make these two connectors. We're going to say I've got an input and an output. In both cases, I'm going to have power and angle, and I'm going to associate my local variables with this connector, and then later that'll all get wired. The cute thing about this, and I should point out, if you look on the input connector, I actually put in an expression. I say, well, the input side is the negative of the power flow, so I'm implicitly assigning a meaning to the sine of power flow. That's how I can get away with a single variable, right? Positive is from in to out, and negative is from out to in, because power can flow both ways on these lines, right? So it's actually very convenient. I don't have to put just variables here. I can do expressions and parameters and whatnot. Nodes are a little more complicated because I don't want to have special nodes for one variable coming or one line coming in, two lines coming in. Instead, a node is really a special case of a conservation rule. Okay? And J-Modelica does this explicitly. They have conservation variables, and they have non-conserved variables. So in this case, the non-conserved variable is something like voltage angle. The conserved variable is current. So this is energy balances 101, right? The sum of the power flowing into the node must equal the demand. The sum of the net power into the node must equal the demand. So I've got D as my demand. I've got the voltage angle on that bus. I use this cute trick called a variable list, which is an arbitrary length vector of variables. I have to do a little cute thing where when I create the bus, so I'm going to call my connector bus. The voltage angle is a simple thing to initialize it with, but I'm going to add power, and I provide what we call an aggregation rule. So this is my conservation rule. And we have to do it this way because I don't know how to form that rule until I know the number of things connected to that bus. So this is a nice trick we can use for supporting conserved quantities. Forming the power flow model then is kind of easy. Okay, I form sets. I'm on slide 18. The top four lines are Python stuff from importing these block models from some other file. I have sets of buses, lines, and generators. I have a parameter of the links that tells me the input and output of every line. I form my buses, lines, and generators. So these are arrays of blocks. And then I form my network by forming constraints where I connect the input of a line with a bus and an output of a line with a bus based on a parameter value. I do generators separately, but you get the same idea. Okay, I connect the generator to a particular bus that it happens to sit at. Okay, that's the whole network flow model. I'm not leaving anything out here. Okay, and the nice thing about this has nothing to do with what's flowing over it. So if I want, well, I should say what we do. That's not solvable. I can't give that to CPLEX. CPLEX wouldn't know what to do with it. So we use a series of post-processing to make this into something CPLEX can solve, or whatever solver of your choice. The basic idea is we do it in three steps. We create the blocks, we wire them up with these constraints, but then we have to do this post-processing step, which is automatically it goes through each of these constraints over connectors, expands that constraint for every pair of variables in the connector. And the last thing it does is go back through all of that and generate any aggregation constraints. So it generates all of our conservation constraints. This takes time, but it's something you don't have to worry about. This all happens black magic behind the scenes. Okay. I should say that it would be really nice if we eliminated redundant variables. We will talk about that in a minute. We don't have a pre-solve yet, but CPLEX does. The nice part about this is, if I want to change the underlying model, if I want to move from a DC to an AC OPF model, That turns out to have a different number of variables. Instead of two, instead of just voltage and power, I actually have to have voltage, real power, and imaginary power. But I don't have to change the network model at all. Okay, I only have to change what blocks I import. So in this case, I'm going to import different rules for constructing these blocks from my block library, wherever that may be. Okay, so slide 21 now. That just says I've got a nice tinker toy approach to forming the model, but that doesn't actually let me get to anything useful. In particular, we want to think about switching decisions. Every one of these switching decisions, if you go back and look at that original model, it's got switching decisions embedded in it. Everyone is embedded with a big M constraint. What we're really doing with these is we're forming disjunctive, implicit disjunctive programs. Right? The transmission line is there or it's not. The generator is there or it's not. I'll come back to that one in a minute. Okay, what we want to do is actually represent that in our models instead of hiding it behind these random m's that happen to be floating around, and we never tell you how to calculate the m value. We just say, assume it's right. Okay, instead what we want is we want to actually do proper disjunctive programming. Now, the neat thing about this is entirely implemented as a plugin. This has never touched the core of PyOmo. Okay, we added two new constructs, a disjunct and a disjunction. So the disjunct is a specialized block. Basically, it's a block that brings along what we call the indicator variable. What Ignacio's notation would be is the big capital Y at the top of the block of square brackets of equations, right? And then a disjunction is a special kind of constraint that expects a list of disjuncts that implements that exclusive OR across all of the disjunctive components. Make sense? Okay. So we want to do that. Let's do a transmission switching model. So I want to make a switchable line. Well, the first thing I need is I've got a line. Now I need an open line. So this is a little sidebar. All right. And we do it, unfortunately, a little more complex than you'd like. You'd like to think this block is really just three variables and I set the bounds on my power variable to be zero. And unfortunately, that doesn't work because we need to know that's a constraint that I'm going to relax. So actually, we have to go and make a power flow constraint and say, yes, indeed, that constraint is this trivial line power is zero. And that way, the relaxations know that this is a constraint to relax, not a hard bound on the variable. Okay? But we create an open line. Then we create an actual switchable line. And I'm going to talk about this one a little bit. We're on slide 23. In one sense, this is a lot of lines of code, but in another sense, it's very simple. I am going to create the closed line. I'm going to create the opened line. I'm going to create the disjunction between the two. Okay. Conceptually, this is clean. Now, here's the cute thing. I'm going to create a from and to connector. Okay. And I'm going to wire things up. I'm going to say the from connector is equal to the closed from and the open from, and the to connector is the closed to and the open to, and we're done. Okay. So if you think about what we just did, is we took an outer block with its own input and output connectors, and we made two little input inner blocks, and we wired them both up. This is neat for what I hope is painfully obvious at this point. The interface to this block is identical to the original block. So if I want to introduce this into my network flow model, I don't have to change anything. So I'm on slide 24. The only thing I change is which block I'm importing. My network flow model is still the same. Okay, so if you want to add transmission switching, you just change which transmission line you're importing. Okay? How do I solve this? Of course, this is certainly not solvable by any solver other than LogMip, I think. Does any other solver support native disjunctive programs?
No, EMP.
EMP, yeah. The way we approach this is through yet another post-processing transformation. Okay, and we support two. We have native relatively automatic transformations for both Big M and convex hull reformulations. If your program happens to be linear, they are completely automatic. If it's nonlinear and you choose to do Big M's, you've got to provide M's. I can't estimate those. That's a hard problem in and of itself. So if it's linear, I can provide you reasonably good, tight estimates based on bounds on variables of the M values. And so it is completely automatic. For nonlinear, it's a little more work. Okay, now I've got a flat model. I can send it to the solver of my choice, and life is good. So let's put all of this together. All right, I create libraries of models. We talked about the switching transmission line. We're on page 26. I talked about the bus model. The beauty of that one never changes. Okay. The generator model is kind of interesting. That one took a long time to write. And the reason it took us a long time to write, apart from the fact that I'm dense, is that all of the models in the literature don't think about these as disjunctive programs. They tend to have these really clever constraints on, in particular, the ramp limits, because the ramping limit of a thermal generator, there's one set of limits for normal operation, but it has separate startup limits and it has separate shutdown limits. And so there's about three major ways in the literature on how to represent that. Do you do it with one binary or three binaries? Do you do it with all of these other things? And it turns out none of those are the right way to think about it, at least in my mind. Okay, what you actually think about it as a three or four set disjunctive model. And suddenly, all the complexity falls away. I have a generator that's either starting up, operating, shutting down, or off. And the modeling becomes trivial. Now, that's easy to say, and hopefully it's obvious after the fact, but it wasn't obvious when we started this exercise. Okay? That was really something where, in a sense, this picture is almost incorrect, because if you model it correctly as a disjunctive program, this little side thing I have at the bottom where ramp limits are kind of handled externally to the generator components, that turns out to fall away. It all falls nicely back into the generator disjuncts. Okay, it's too hard to plot, so I didn't change the picture. But that's the beauty of it, is that we actually can think about it from a logically simpler way and represent it in a logically simpler way and still get a math program out. And so what math program do we get out? And there's two parts of this. Do I get the same math program? And how much do I pay for the convenience of not having to do all this work myself as a modeler? And the answer is, right now, you pay a lot. Okay. Now, some of it is, you pay a lot to work in Python. Okay, we've spent a fair amount of time trying to not be stupid. When we started off, things were very slow. We're now down within an order of magnitude of Ample, and we're almost comparable to GAMS. And that's good enough for us because this is open source software and we legally don't compete with either academia or industry. So we're not ever going to be in the business of trying to do that. We're happy enough. This is a research tool. We're happy. Now, then there's also the cost of all of these transformations we've talked about. Okay. And I've got 10 minutes. Perfect. And so we're on slide 27, and the cost is significant but not outrageous, and we're getting better at it. Without tuning anything, this is what we're looking at. So this is kind of a dense plot, and there's about five things I want to talk about. We'll see how many I get to. We looked at a couple instances. The five best model is a trivial instance. Okay, this is what the power industry would consider the trivial toy model. Okay. Cplex can solve it in the order of 10-20 seconds. Okay. The RTS-96 test case is a 73-bus model. So, 73-bus. Okay. Arguably, from an industrial standpoint, that's still a trivial model. From a computational standpoint, it's not. Okay. And what we're looking at in this plot are... three different times, well, four technically. Instantiation time is basically the overhead of Python parsing your stuff and creating the original block-based object model. Then we expand the connectors, and we have a time for that. And then we convert all the disjunctive programming constraints into Big M through the Big M relaxation. And the total time is not the sum of the first three because there's other things that have to happen as well. The total time includes things like writing out the final model for the solver and things like that. And there's a cost. For large models, it can be significant. But it's not outrageous. And I know I'm saying it's not outrageous, but, you know, model generation times on the order of solve time for the 5-bus case, I'm okay with that. The RTS-96 test case, and I don't know if I have it on this, I have it two slides later, But the 24-hour version of the RTS 96 case, it does solve at the root node, by the way, after applying heuristics, in 3 days. Okay. So, a couple thousand seconds to generate the model. Believe it or not, I can live with that. Okay. The problem here has to do with some things in the way PyOMA was originally written. We've never optimized it for this manner of operation, and so it's somewhat memory inefficient, and that's why I don't have numbers for the 12-hour, for the full case. I should say the columns. The flat model is the original model I presented on, like, slide five. Okay, when we blocked it, that was the original, just take conceptual components and put them into blocks with connectors. Block plus GDP, where we only use GDP for the transmission lines, is the next column. And finally is the block GDP with both transmission and generation. And I should point out that that model is not the same model, and we'll see that in the next slide. Because when I formed that three-level disjunction, that changed the number of binaries in the problem. The other thing, and I hinted at this at the beginning, you really have to rely on a pre-solve. If you think about what we do, we form all of these trivial A equals B constraints in the model. Okay? You got to get rid of those. All right? Now, since this is a mixed integer linear program, we've got some really nice solvers, Cplex, Gorobi, Express, and all of them have great pre-solves. And so what you can see is the raw model is huge, but after pre-solve, it turns out we get almost identical models. Okay? So it all pre-solves down to about the same model without any special... This is not hand-waving or special tuning of Cplex. It just does its magic. If you notice, you see in the last one with generators, we get a different model, and that's because of the explicit disjunctive programming representation does add binaries to the problem. Ironically, that solves faster. Okay? Now, I started with uncertainty, and I still haven't gotten to it. We're on slide 29. We've historically managed it through spending reserves. That is, we just put a buffer in the system. But that's really not what we're doing. What we really are trying to do and what we're required to do is a reliability requirement. That is, the grid has to be up a certain number of hours per year, or it has to be a certain number of hours on average, between a power interruption. That's the real requirement, but we don't model it that way because, among other things, the problem's too hard. Okay, so we kind of proxy it with the spinning reserve thing that is statistically going to satisfy our statistical reliability requirement. Now, alternatively, we'd actually like to directly model that reliability requirement. Okay, and you can do it a couple ways. You can do a robust optimization. That's basically what N-1 is. It's a form of robust optimization. Or I could do stochastic programming with some appropriate expectation. Appropriate, by the way, is not mean value. It's not expected value. Okay, it turns out to be a tail-conditioned expectation. We like CVAR, but that's an academic argument. Okay? The problem is you now have to optimize that expectation over a sufficiently large number of scenarios. Complicating this is not two-stage, the trivial version is two-stage, but really, if you want to think about it, this is a large 25-stage problem. It has enormous scenario trees, and this is a nuanced one. We have integer decisions at every stage, which means benders is not the way to go. Okay? But what can you do? Well, think about the way the problem looks. A stochastic programming problem is a block diagonal problem, right? Every block in my diagonal, that's basically a state, or it's basically a scenario in my scenario tree, right? And then I've got some complicating constraints that bind them all together. We like to call those the non-anticipativity constraints, right? That is, I can't look into the future. My decision at the first stage has to be uniform across all my scenarios, okay? And same with second, third, and fourth, and fifth, across the scenarios on that branch of the tree. All right, so how do I do this? Well, I really don't want to write that thing because they're all the same. It's a deterministic scenario that I replicate, and then I have to solve. And I can solve the extensive form, that is, take the whole kit and caboodle, hand it to Cplex or Gorobi or Express or what have you, and hope for an answer. And if that works, great. But what if it doesn't? Can I decompose it? And the answer is, of course you could. There's a lot of ways you could think about it, and there's one in particular. We think about, and I'm now on slide 31, we think about the decomposition instead of in a time-based decomposition, which is kind of what Bender's is, right? I've got a first stage problem and then later stage. We decompose across the scenario trees using with an algorithm called progressive hedging. And the idea is pretty simple, okay? It's mediated decision-making. I've got a bunch of people, we'll call those the individual scenarios, and they're out there saying, I'm going to optimize each one independently. And they all come up with, here's my best answer. And then you've got a mediator that basically penalizes people from disagreeing with consensus. Okay, we implement this as a weighted penalty squared of your deviation from the average value. Okay, there's lots of nuances in particularly how to pick that penalty parameter row. But in the LP case, it's provably convergent. In the MIP case, it's a heuristic. I think it's provably convergent for the nonlinear case, but I haven't seen the proof yet, if it's convex. If it's non-convex, of course, all bets are off. Because this relies on being able to solve the individual subproblems to optimality. Okay? Now, why is this cool? One, I should be able to automate all of this. Right? It's just generating individual scenarios, solving them independently, penalizing them, distributing the penalty parameters. I not only can solve them independently, I can do it in parallel. And so we've got this package, it's inside of Cooper, called PySP, which is a generic implementation of progressive hedging, which lets us do this trick. And it's got lots of extensions for getting this to work in a heuristically good sense for mixed integer linear problems. And we have used it for some really big mixed integer linear problems. Okay, and there's lots of tricks that start coming in. You get cycling, we can break cycles. There's tricks you can do to kind of kick it to converge already. There's a couple other nuances in there. But for the most part, it works. And it works in parallel. It's got parallelization routines built into it natively. Okay? And so the nice thing about this is, remember I said that RTS 96 case took 3 hours or 3 days to solve. It solved, but it took 3 days. And the real problem with that is, I need the answer in an hour. All right, I have to have the answer in an hour, maybe 4 hours at the upper end. But if I start this at 6 in the afternoon, the schedule starts at midnight, I certainly don't have 7 hours, right? So what can I do? I mean, I've got this N-1 problem, and if you think about it, robust optimization is really very analogous to stochastic programming. I've got each of these scenarios for each of these contingencies. So can we use progressive hedging? And the answer is, we're working on it. Logically, all the infrastructure works. We can take this, we can break it up. There's some questions on how you want to break it up into individual scenarios. It turns out, we think, the right way to think about this is every scenario is actually going to have the base case replicated and we'll have a single contingency scenario with it. It does solve one of our original problems. Our root nodes solve much, much faster. Unfortunately, the problem's not as highly constrained, so it actually enters the branch and boundary. So just because the root node solves quickly, and we get an incumbent pretty quickly. Optimality is a little more nebulous. We're still working on this. This is hopefully going to be something that we'll get answers to, because what this will allow us to do is actually solve some of these more expensive N-1 reliability problems more directly. We're doing similar work with stochastic programming to handle uncertainties. So this is reliability for uncertainties for example, high penetration renewables. We're doing a very similar approach. And that turns out to work remarkably well. So kind of to wrap all of this up, the idea of blocks really has changed the way we think about modeling. We can do component reuse. We can do logical manipulation of the models themselves. And then we can write algorithms, albeit some of them are heuristic, but algorithms that can address some of these really large problems in a way that might actually make them computationally tractable. So, but as a final parting shot, all of this is kind of fun, but by the way, it's not the real problem. The real problem that I haven't really mentioned is that, of course, the power grid isn't linear. The real problem is the ACOPF. That is mixed integer, the unit commitment ACOPF is mixed integer, nonlinear, non-convex. love to be able to solve that one. So anybody want to take a stab at it? But with that, thank you. I should acknowledge everybody. The names on the right are people who are committing to the code. We have lots of users. These are some of the ones I know about. And we've got lots of online documentation that I'd be more than happy to point you to. So we try to share as much of this as we can. So thanks. Okay,
thank you. Let's see. So I guess we do have time for questions. And I think, as usual, we'll try to see if we have some questions from people out there who are listening to the talk. And anybody would like to ask a question to John? Well, was very shy. No questions? What about here? Anybody? Yeah.
In the contingency problems, are they all opens?
No. Can you repeat the question? So the question was, are the contingency subproblems LPs? And the answer is, it depends on how you want to formulate the problem. I said no, and I actually don't mean it. In the Hedman model, they could be thought of as, the contingency case itself could be thought of as an LP, because they disallow transmission switching. In reality, they don't have any binaries. They lock everything down. In reality, it is mixed integer, because in reality, you have fast start generators, and you should allow, I think, for transmission switching in the contingency cases. But this whole transmission switching thing is somewhat new to the utilities. So it's not something that I think, it's a known option, but I don't think anybody has it as a regular course of action, if that makes any sense.
Well, and then my related question is on slide 31. You were explaining that this method, you basically use quadratic penalty, you separate the problem and then use quadratic penalties to penalize deviation. And you said in the case of LP, if the original problems are LP, that my confusion is this. Aren't all of the subproblems mixed integer problems? And then if you try to use a quadratic penalty, that won't necessarily guarantee convergence.
So there were a couple questions here, but the gist of it is, in progressive hedging, we use a quadratic penalty, and if the subproblems are MIPS, how is that convergent? And the answer is, when I said that when the subproblems are LPs, so if your original problem is an LP, so for example, just the OPF, then it's provably convergent. If your original problem is a MIP, of course your subproblems are MIPS, and now it's a heuristic. The quadratic, you can leave it in if you've got a good, I mean, you know, a lot of our big linear programming solvers can handle quadratic objectives, and that's fine. We also can do automatic linearization of that quadratic term, and it turns out not to affect convergence, at least in the cases that we've looked at.
Yeah.
Do you compare the performance by reformulating the generalization programming with again or with overformulation?
I was waiting for somebody to ask that. The answer is no. And the reason I didn't is that the root node is already hard enough. And making the root node harder with a convex hull reformulation, I mean, just physical size. You know, the really sad thing is that RTS 96 case, the stars, if you notice in that lower left-hand corner where we were having stars for not no answers, the reason is we ran out of memory. And we ran out of memory on a machine with almost 100 gig. Okay. Now, a lot of that, I almost feel sad saying that, because a lot of that's some inefficiencies in the Paiomo environment that we're fixing, because we never really intended it to be used in this manner. We're kind of putting this in. But some of it is, these are big problems. And so, no, we didn't look at the root.
Okay.
Do you also try to compare subgrading method instead of
some, pardon?
I think maybe if I can interject very briefly here, because it's related to BJ's, looking at the progressive hedging, what's exactly the difference with Lagrangian decomposition? Because actually,
it is a form of Lagrangian decomposition.
If you have the quadratic term, it's the augmented Lagrangian,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it is a form.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that goes back to... Because of Woodruff, right?
Yeah, because Dave Woodruff's on the project. that's the tool of choice by the guys who wrote it. I didn't write the PySP module, so that's John Paul and Dave Woodruff, and that's their that was their first hammer, and it turns out to be a remarkably effective one. I mean, I've talked about things like benders. We've got kind of sort of generalized benders implementation, but we don't use it as much because of the kind of problems we're looking at. So if you'd like to write a subgradient method, we would happily accept it. This is open. I should have mentioned, all of this is open source code, so we welcome contributions from the community.
So Modelica uses a similar concept of blobs and connectors, right?
Yep.
So is there a difference between Paiomo and Modelica? If not, did you get a chance to compare it?
So the question is that a lot of these block concepts exist in Modelica, and the answer is absolutely. And we've actually spoken to some of the, particularly the JModelica developers, a lot when we were coming up with this idea, and some of their ideas formed how we did it in Paiomo. Do we do direct numerical comparisons? We did not, in part because Modelica is really targeted at a different audience. In a sense, I mean, it really is targeted more towards DAE systems natively, and so in that sense, we're coming at it from a different angle. It would be fun. You want to do it?
By the way, one question I do have: you showed the use of the disjunctions and the transformations. But I'm curious: do you also support logic propositions?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Mostly because I ran out of time when I was writing the module to write the transformations. I mean, some of the logic propositions are easy,
right?
And some are not. And the recursive algorithm, I just didn't have time to write at the time. It's on the back burner. There's three tickets in the ticket system asking for it. But, I mean, of course, there's no reason we can't. And we do write logical conditions on the indicator variables. They're available in the modeling system, so you can write them manually, but we don't have an automatic way. You know, implication is the nasty one, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So,
any other question?
Yeah.
Just one more follow-up on it. If I understood correctly, when you modeled the disjunctions using a convex envelope, and that was the, you had a two approaches. One was a big M reformulation. The other was a mixed integer convex envelope formulation. Is that correct?
Well, just the convex hull relaxation.
Convex hull, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and the second one does better, right?
No.
Okay. No.
Depends on the problem.
Okay.
Very much depends on the problem.
I was curious if anybody had implemented the second one in the flat formulation in the literature, or if all the... Okay.
we can talk about it.
For power systems.
Okay. Oh, for power systems. The question was if anybody's done the convex hull reformulation of some of these logical constraints for power systems. Not that I know of. In fact, I've never seen it expressed explicitly represented as Big M in some of the at least in the power system literature that we keep circulating in.
Sumit behind you can talk to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. I know this is something Sumit's been working on. So.
Okay, all right. Well, since we reached the end of the time, I'd really like to thank John very much for a very nice presentation, and thank you very much, and everybody out there, and also thank you for attending the seminar. Okay? Thank you.
Again, thanks.